We regret to announce the death of Mr. David Herbert Lawrence, which occurred in a sanatorium near Nice. So wrote the Manchester Guardian in March 1930. Mr. Lawrence, it went on, was a writer who has exercised a more potent influence, perhaps over his generation, than any of his contemporaries. Hello and welcome to the Arnolfini in Bristol, where D.H. Lawrence is our great life today. A rebel, in that obituary's words, against all the accepted values of modern Western civilization. Well, maybe. Lawrence died very young, just 44 years old. But in that time, his output was extraordinary, both in poetry and in books, which famously include Sons and Lovers, Women in Love, and Lady Chatterley's Lover. He's chosen here today by the poet and performer John Hegley, and I believe that before you start explaining why you've nominated Lawrence, John, you want to read us some of his verse.
I wanted to read The Tortoise, because The Tortoise is the one that I love the most. And this is a bit, and there's four Tortoise poems. They might be hiding under rocks somewhere, some other ones. But so I'm going to read you a bit of Tortoise, and I'll say my little thing. So he's addressing the tortoise. Good idea. Row on, then, small pebble, over the clods of the autumn, wind, chilled sunshine, young gaiety. Does he look for a companion? No. No, don't think it. He doesn't know he is alone. Isolation is his birthright, this atom. To row forward and reach himself tall on spiny toes, to travel, to burrow into a little loose earth, afraid of the night, to crop a little substance, to move and to be quite sure that he is moving. Moving and answering a mobile phone. Surprisingly, this creature, this natural world has the answers. Moving and being himself. Slow and unquestioned and inordinately there. Oh, stoic. Wandering in the slow triumph of his own existence. Ringing the soundless bell of his presence in chaos and biting the frail grass arrogantly, decidedly arrogantly. And here's my little introduction that I've written about these matters. 36 years ago, I wrote a dissertation on D.H. Lawrence's ideas. There was one copy. I lost it. When Nathan Pendleton introduced me in his contest, Bards in Their Eyes, I was D.H. Lawrence. I lost that as well. But I have found in the artist's work delight in torrents. In his novels, he can build a relationship and take it apart with what you might call Brunel efficiency. And with his poems, sometimes you have to wade, sometimes you have to skip, but the gems are there if you dip into the word pile. He couldn't paint, but he didn't care. He did it and he got it out there. And he was quite happy to use the word fecund 6 times in 2 pages.
Also here on the stage at the Arnolfini, we have the author Jeff Dyer, who wrote Out of Sheer Rage, a riveting kind of non-biography of Lawrence's life. Jeff, you recently paid, I believe, a large sum of money for a yellowing letter written by D.H. Lawrence. Why did you do that?
Because I wanted it very badly, in a way that I suspect. I mean, it's this strange thing about Lawrence. I don't think you love Lawrence's work without being besotted by the man. I think even people who really admire E.M. Forster's work, they would never have had a picture of him on their bedroom wall the way I did when I was young. I had a picture of Lawrence on my wall in the way now that kids might have a picture of, I don't know, David Beckham or Eminem. And in a way, I see the purchase of that letter, which I've got framed on my study wall, as a sort of unbroken continuation of that teenage thing whereby I had a picture of Lawrence on my wall.
And what did this yellowing piece of paper, what does it say?
Oh, it's a fantastic letter. It's written when he was living in Florence, writing what became Lady Chatterley's Lover. It's at a phase in Lawrence's life when he's convinced that he's a painter. There's a lovely line in it where he says something like, I much prefer painting to writing. It takes so much less out of the soul. And, of course, the obvious response to that from people knowledgeable about art would be, yes, art like yours takes less out of the soul.
It's funny, you know, you've met in me the exception to the rule you've just stated, that you've got to find Lawrence the man interesting as well as the work. I've always found Lawrence the man slightly tiresome. It's the work that I think is fantastic.
Well, I mean, practically everybody who met Lawrence, even if they only met him for a couple of minutes, ended up writing some sort of account of meeting him, because quite often, you can see this happening now really with people, that there are many people around alive today, and for them, seeing Jimi Hendrix was one of the biggest experiences of their lives. And with Lawrence, certainly, he left people in no doubt at all that meeting him was a huge experience, for good or for ill.
I've often wondered what his voice sounded like, and apparently we've been unable to find any archive of D.H. Lawrence's voice. Last year, somebody found some archive that was thought to have been lost of Peter Cook's in their attic. Well, if any of you have any grandparents that have any D.H. Lawrence, I'd love to hear the sound of his voice. What do you think, John, he sounded like?
Well, the dialect poems are fantastic. I mean, the one about the miner who has an accident is a very moving, understated piece. He's obviously very attuned to the accents of his birthplace.
Yeah, he had a Midlands accent.
Yes. I like the description of Lawrence in your book as having thin wrists and thick trousers. Yeah, give us, to the extent that you can, a sort of word picture of the man.
Wait, sorry, were you looking at me?
Yes.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Yeah,
yeah. Lawrence was 5'9", which for somebody of that time and from his class, let's say, was really quite tall. Obviously, the toff Virginia Woolf was a good deal taller. He was extremely thin. One thing that doesn't come out in the black and white photographs is that he had red hair, and he kept complaining that the person you saw in photographs wasn't really him because of that hair. Mm. There's a great description of what he looked like by this guy who nobody's heard of called Jamie D'Angelo, and here is a quick description of him. Lawrence is ridiculous as only an Englishman can be ridiculous. His face is a combination of Tolstoy, George Bernard Shaw, and Abraham Lincoln. Very pallid skin and a semi-bushy, semi-goat-like red beard. You expect an enormous body to support that head, but it's only a long, gaunt, raw-boned, awkward succession of ungainly articulations. Undescribable clothes. I love that. I mean, the idea that clothes can be undescribable is extraordinary. Skinny, weedy. I guess the point that everybody made was there was an incredible contrast between his amazing vitality and this rather scrawny frame of his.
Yeah, and an amazing haircut as well that looked like it'd been done by Frida in her sleep. With a bread knife that was blunt.
It might well have done, because they really prided themselves on being very self-sufficient and not having... Lawrence hated the idea of having servants around, not that he could afford them. But, yeah, he liked the way that they did all their own chores. He put up shelves, they made their own marmalade, all this kind of stuff.
Well, to Frida, in just a moment, it strikes me already that it's going to be almost impossible to cover an entire life, all the books, the letters, the poetry, the paintings, the travel, the lovers, the ideas, the tuberculosis, in a radio programme that doesn't quite add up to 30 minutes in length. So what I'm going to do is try to give the flavour of Lawrence's life. Before we start on the biography and the early years and so on, I just want to read something he wrote. The date is November 1915, so he was already 30 years old, and he was travelling to Garsington Manor, to the home of one of his old friends. When I drive across this country, with the autumn falling and rustling to pieces, I am so sad for my country, for this great wave of civilization, 2,000 years, which is collapsing, that it is hard to live. So much beauty and pathos of old things passing away, and no new things coming. He sort of hated England, its stultifications, its rigidity, its middle classes, and yet he obviously passionately loved England too, and he was so English, wasn't he? You can't imagine him coming from anywhere else.
Yes, he was. I've written this piece about him and him being English and basically suffering, and we'll come on to more of this, at the hands of the establishment through his novels and with his paintings. I finished this morning. So whether it can be done or not, I don't know. I wish I could have fought like David, the Goliath of the States. I could have done with his slingshot, but my aim's not great. They called me a spy. It's not very nice, but the Croydon boys, they always called me Mr. Lawrence, sir. And there's those who call me a prophet, especially my agent. But come off it, I prefer Bert. I have been hurt. Yeah, well,
Jeff Dyer, a challenge. A challenge here. I'm not going to ask you to sing, but I'm going to ask you, in a just a few minute sketch, to set out for us where Lawrence was born and give us some idea who his parents were and explain why you think he moved from that into writing.
Oh, yeah, so he's born in Eastwood, near Nottingham, and his father's a collier. My father was a working man was he. He writes in a poem. And his mother was a superior soul. A superior soul was she. She was of a slightly sort of higher class and was slightly more aspirational than her collier husband. And also, crucially, he meets, when he's in his teens, Jesse Chambers, who lives out in this farm where they've got books, and there's this great kind of awakening in him of the cultural life extending beyond the social circumstances of his actual.
He was the first local pupil to win a county scholarship to Nottingham High School.
Yes,
so that obviously had ambitions from quite a young age.
Yeah, that's right. And also there was, I guess there was that atmosphere of working class cultural advancement that was very sort of prevalent at the time. He gets a teaching certificate. I think he gets a job as a clerk in a company making surgical appliances, I think. Of course, he hated that. Then he becomes a teacher down in Croydon, and his teaching career is brought to an end by one of the first bouts of illness that he suffers. He succumbs to pneumonia.
He hated teaching, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I think he pretty much hated the idea of work in the sense of a job that you had to do. And for him, I mean, although he worked incredibly hard as a writer, I mean, given what he'd seen of his dad's work, of course, it felt like a life of permanent... I suppose he obliterated the distinction between work and leisure.
Lawrence has been caught up recently in the current round of financial cuts because the visitor's centre in the town where he was born, as Jeff was saying, Eastwood, is likely to shut. It's led to an outcry from Salman Rushdie and others, including you, apparently, Jeff.
Yeah, well, I signed this letter in the rather slaggish-like way when they said, oh, do you want to sign this letter with Martin Amis and Salman Rushdie? I'd have been willing to sign it, irrespective of what it was about, just to be in that kind of company. And got a letter back from the councillor saying, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. This is not really in danger. And if you want to make a really useful contribution, rather than signing these stupid petitions, why don't you pitch in with some money?
Yeah.
Which somehow I've managed to resist doing, in spite of my love of Lawrence.
Maybe the wrong letter to you, but I think Salman Rushdie, given what the British taxpayer has paid for Salman's protection over the years, it wouldn't be a bad idea. John, Lawrence, really, with a kind of inner determination, worked his way into a situation where he could write and be a poet. You used to busk your songs outside a shoe shop in Hull.
Yeah, that was the beginning. I was singing there, and I remember the two women came to the edge of the shoe shop and were smiling, and I thought, oh, yes, you can give something out with this.
March 1912, Lawrence met Frieda Weekly, her maiden name being von Richthofen. Jeff, tell me about this extraordinary woman.
Yes, well, if Brendan Maddox's excellent biography of Lawrence, The Married Man, is to be believed, within about, I don't know, an hour of meeting Frieda, she got Lawrence into bed. And given the kind of difficult...
Her husband was late to come to the lunch, apparently, and she... Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Fatal. Fatal unpunctuality.
And, of course, I mean, Frieda wasn't Lawrence's first girlfriend. I mean, he'd had sexual experiences before. He'd been engaged to Jesse Chambers. But I guess his experience of relations with women, partly because, of course, of this abnormally close relationship with his mother, and particularly of sex, it had been incredibly fraught and traumatic. And here was this person from Germany, filled with all the latest sort of avant-garde ideas about sex and sexuality, a real force of nature. They eloped. She left weekly, her husband, and then he made it a condition that she only had very, very limited access to seeing her children. And they remained together through thick and thin, and it was a famously sort of tempestuous relationship. There's this is sort of absurd image. Frieda, big fat thing. Lawrence, of course, really, really skinny. And there's this...
Well, she wasn't exactly a big fat thing. He described her. He described her as having a Rubenesque figure. A Rubenesque figure with the face of a Grecian goddess, which I find a very attractive combination.
Yeah. You know, I would point you in the direction of the photographs and rest my case at that. But the point I wanted to get to is that there's this fantastically absurd image of weedy old Lawrence trying to throttle Frieda, saying, "I'm the master." And, of course, it was the great thing about the relationship, I think, is that she wouldn't let Lorenzo be the master. He met his match in her, in terms of, you know, not in terms of writing, but in terms of just vitality and force, I think.
John, can I ask you to read out Frieda's description of seeing him as he enters the house? Would you like to read it out for me? It's in bold there.
Of course. "I see him before me. As he entered the house, a long, thin figure. Quick, straight legs. He seemed so utterly simple. He said he'd finished with his attempts at knowing women."
You're listening to The Great Life of D.H. Lawrence, chosen by the poet and performer John Hegley, and Jeff Dyer is here offering expert advice. I'd like to reveal my own hand here as someone who considers that Lawrence, at his best, and there's acres of his worst, was one of Britain's great poets of all time. And having stated that, I'm going to read my own favourite, the second half of a poem called Shadows. "And if, in the changing phases of man's life, I fall in sickness and in misery, my wrists seem broken and my heart seems dead, and strength is gone, and my life is only the leavings of a life, and still among it all, snatches of lovely oblivion and snatches of renewal, odd wintry flowers upon the withered stem, yet new, strange flowers, such as my life has not brought forth before, new blossoms of me. Then I must know that still I am in the hands of the unknown God. He is breaking me down to his own oblivion, to send me forth on a new morning, a new man." Jeff, in your book about Lawrence, you travelled to many of the places he also went to with Frieda on what people have called his savage pilgrimage abroad. Run us quickly through this part of his life, an extraordinary journey.
Oh, Lord, yes. Well, he was forced to stay in Britain for the duration of the First World War, and as soon as the war was over, he went to Europe.
He was a pacifist, what wasn't he, John? Refused to have anything to do with war.
Yeah.
We could say a bit more about that. With his evangelical sense of his own importance, he moved in this circle of, a very well-connected toffs, and he and Bertrand Russell became convinced that they could form an alliance which would stop the war being continued. And this was a great idea, and Bertrand Russell, in common with virtually everybody else, was overwhelmed by the force of Lawrence's personality for a while. But of course, then the honeymoon came to an end when Lawrence said that actually the real roots of Bertrand Russell's alleged pacifism were to be found in the fact that really he wanted to split people's heads open. This is the classic kind of Lawrence relationship, it seems to me. And after that, this analysis of Lawrence's made Bertrand Russell want to commit suicide. Anyway, where did they go after the First World War, him and Frieda? First of all, to mainland Europe. Then they settled for a while in Sicily, where they were incredibly happy. He liked the way that he was as far south in Europe as you could get. And he wanted to go to America, when suddenly, on a whim, he said he's going to go there via Australia. And since he was en route to Australia, he thought, "I know, I'll stop off in Ceylon or Sri Lanka." He absolutely hated Ceylon, and he took what I think could only be described as an intense personal dislike to the Buddha. He came across these Buddhist shrines. You know, we all love those images of the reclining Buddha, which are so sedate. Lawrence would see these in what he called these rat hole shrines. He'd see the reclining Buddha and he'd just be hissing, "Stand up!" He got incredibly ill in Sri Lanka, not surprisingly, and then moved on to Australia. I mean, he had this incredible response to Australia, whereby within a couple of weeks of being there, he was sensing, you know, the song lines. He intuited the Aboriginal dream time in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fantastic novel. It's called Kangaroo.
Just to slightly object to that, I think loads of Kangaroo is bad. If you want to read Lawrence at his best about Australia, I urge you to read the incredible letters which he wrote from Australia, where in more or less unmediated time, you've got his raw response to this strangely unpopulated continent.
I like his description in Kangaroo of the Australian. He liked Australians in lots of ways, but he said that there was something about the hale and hearty manner of an Australian that he said you would meet an Australian and you would encounter them and talk to them and get to know them and they you and then depart, and you would feel that you had sailed slap through his consciousness and out the other side, like those ghost ships that we used to read about. What do you think he was looking for, John? What was he living on? What's the purpose of this wandering?
As Jeff was saying earlier, he would have been quite happy having a much less travelled or intensely sort of moving time. He says, letter to Edward Marsh, 14th of October, 1913. He says, if I'd got the smallest income, I should be delighted to loaf forever. To some extent, I feel there's a lot of this stuff. And he says he would have been happy not to have written anything elsewhere in the letters. He says it in there somewhere. But what he did do was to perceive. And he did write about stuff, and he did write his letters. I guess he would have still written the letters. The letters are fantastic. They are fantastic. He would have also gone out on walks, and the piece about the flowers, I've only read one other person who's got such a brilliant knowledge of the natural word, and that's Richard... Is it Richard Mabey or Richard Mabey? I don't know if anybody knows Mabey, how to pronounce that. But he wrote a wonderful book called Nature Cure. Fantastic. And D.H. Lawrence's stuff about flowers in Tuscany, it's just an amazing...
Could you read us a little bit of that?
Flowers in Tuscany. We hadn't thought I was going to read Flowers in Tuscany, so I am going to have to look for it and look unprofessional because I don't... but I'll... I'll tell you what, you look for... Matthew, would you look for Flowers in Tuscany?
Yes.
I'll read him a poem.
Yeah.
This is D.H. Lawrence and Misrepresentation. This is about Lady Chatterley and talking to a chum about him. I spoke with Judith Latterly about the tale of Lady Chatterley. She said the furore had been such a farce. The story's not one of eroticism, said Judith. The pith of the story is class. Or class, as you could say, if you were... Have you found it?
Well, I haven't found Flowers in Tuscany, but...
See?
But while I've been looking for it, you've usefully taken us past Lady Chatterley's Lover, which everybody knows about, so we don't need to talk about that. How was he viewed in Britain? You interrupt me. Jeff, tell...
I just wondered if you wanted me to continue with this to say where he'd been.
Yes.
And some of his motives. So he loved being in Australia for a while. Marvellous air, marvellous sun and sky, strange, vast, empty country. But, well, it's always an anticlimax of buts. I just don't want to stay, that's all. But I love trying things and discovering how I hate them. From Australia, he goes on to take up an invitation from somebody to settle in New Mexico. Which, of course, this is something we who've grown up on a foggy little island can identify with. When he gets to the vastness of New Mexico, it's the greatest experience of the outdoors he's ever had. And for a while, of course, he's incredibly happy there. Then they all start falling out. He goes down to Mexico where he gets incredibly ill, back to New Mexico where he recuperates, and then will come back to Europe, settles in near Florence, where he writes Lady Chatterley's Lover, and always has this idea that if he could get back to New Mexico, he'd regain his health.
I, John, love Lawrence as a writer, as a reporter, as an observer, especially of children.
Yeah.
I love the evocative descriptions he gives of people and of places. But ever since I studied Lawrence for A-level, I've been left behind by the sort of proto-psycho babble about
all that, not good.
Oh, good, someone...
I mean, you know, you can skip that, though, can't you? You know, you can tell here it comes and just move on, you know. I mean, it's not good, that stuff.
His reputation has never recovered from the kicking that he got from the feminists, particularly from Kate Millett in the 1970s. And I suspect, really, I mean, you said I paid a lot for that letter. Actually, Lawrence is going pretty cheap at the moment because I think probably his reputation in academic circles is probably at an all-time low. But I think his very best writing, and this is, I think, where John and I are in absolute agreement, it's actually weirdly to be found in the letters, where you've got that completely unmediated, extraordinary responsiveness to the world, without that weird, obsessive sexuality where he's talking all the time about the loins of darkness. You know, where are the loins? It seems a peculiarly movable part of the body, and without that kind of stuff that he's always going on about, you know, the river of dissolution and all this kind of stuff.
John?
The reader has to make an effort in engaging with D.H. Lawrence. You've got to make an effort. There's bits that ain't much good. There are bits that are unbelievable.
Yeah.
You mentioned education and children. So this is a poem relating to that and to reading stuff out. So this is about talking to my friend Simon Munry, the comedic genius. Simon asked if I knew D.H. Lawrence's three simple rules about bringing up children. I said no, and so he told me. Rule one, leave them alone. Rule two, leave them alone. Rule three, leave them alone. One wonders about rule four. A week later, I am sat on a train next to an Indian undergraduate. I read the young man D.H. Lawrence's elephant poem, hoping it might remind him of home. He asks me to leave him alone.
My thanks to John Hegley for proposing D.H. Lawrence and to Jeff Dyer for offering his expert advice. Goodbye.